series of music is by my guest, first guest this afternoon. His name is Michael Kamin. He's originally from Wisconsin. He is a singer, a songwriter, and acoustic guitarist. He's worked very hard to cultivate a sound of his own. According to his bio, he claims influences from Leo Kottke to Tom Waits, Peter Gabriel. His sound strikingly original with a hint of Americana songwriting backed by a deftly picked guitar. Well, this according to your press, Michael Kamin. First of all, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me. I was listening to that description and thinking about how I have to live up to all those words.
Well, I doubt that you'll have any problem because you seem to have quite a following here. You mentioned in your bio that your influences were Leo Kottke, Tom Waits, Peter Gabriel. That's certainly a wide variety of people. Can you tell me how they contributed to you finding your own particular voice, your own particular sound?
Absolutely. Leo Kottke is by far my biggest influence in terms of guitar playing. I first started listening to him when I was 14 or 15 years old and have seen him in concert several times and had the pleasure of meeting him. And his music in terms of the guitar has been something I've always felt very connected to. It kind of falls under my fingers really well, and I really connect with it rhythmically. So he's by far my biggest influence on the guitar as an instrument. Tom Waits and Peter Gabriel are more so influences in terms of songwriting. I really connected with Peter Gabriel's sort of abstract sense of lyrics. I mean, you listen to a lot of his music and you don't always necessarily know exactly what he's talking about, but it's a very interesting in terms of the way he uses lyrics, whereas Tom Waits I connect to much more in a literal sense. He has much more of a sort of story song-esque approach. Mm-hmm. So I try to kind of balance those two sides of things when it comes to songwriting.
Mm-hmm. I'll be talking to you a little bit more about lyrics later on. I see that that you, it also says that you, because of the influences of these artists, that you were led to explore the world of fingerstyle guitar. Mm-hmm. So I am not a guitarist. So tell me, first off, what is fingerstyle guitar?
Well, fingerstyle guitar is, first and foremost, a style of guitar that is generally played on a steel string acoustic guitar as opposed to a nylon string guitar, although there are some people who are what might be considered crossover artists which play it on a nylon string guitar as well. And it's really a mix of a variety of things, primarily folk, blues, jazz, and classical, kind of all mixed into one and mashed up together. Mm-hmm. It steals a lot from classical guitar in terms of the technique required. You have to study a lot of classical guitar, right hand technique and left hand technique, to have the technical skills to be able to play fingerstyle guitar. So it's really that kind of melting pot of all these different types of music, and the common thread is the steel string acoustic guitar. So you could go and see a fingerstyle guitarist play and hear something that has kind of a blues tint to it one time, and then the next song he plays might be more jazzy or classical, or you might not even be able to put it into a genre, you know, because mm-hmm. it might be kind of a mix of everything. And it's a style that, you know, is exactly as you kind of mentioned, not a lot of people really know about it in terms of it being a literal style, but when they hear it, they kind of always connect to it and, mm-hmm. and enjoy it. So,
well, when you say we hear some, what do you?
Sure.
What can
we hear? Why don't we play this tune, Sea Legs, which is off of my recording Cold Pines. It's track number 6. This is a good example of a tune that, you know, it doesn't really fit into any of those styles. It's just finger style, you know. So
here we go. That's Michael Kamin picking and grinning, a tune called Sea Legs, a tune that he composed. He offered that to us as an example of fingerstyle guitar playing. Very nice, Michael.
Thank you.
Tell me, though, about the composition of that piece. Where were you in your life when you wrote that piece? What inspired it?
I wrote that probably... Oh, probably in 2006, 2007. I can't really cite any one specific thing that inspired it. It was a tune where I was kind of generally in a stage in my life where, or in writing music, where I wanted to be more melodic in what I was writing. I wanted to get away from... A lot of times in fingerstyle guitar music, you have a real strong alternating bass. Your thumb goes back and forth on the lower strings of the guitar, and I was trying to get away from doing that in my music so much to try to push my music into a different sound. So I was looking for better melody in the piece and trying to get away from using that alternating bass, That particular song kind of it grew out of the very opening riff of the piece, which is kind of a very warm major sounding A7 chord, A major 7 chord, and that little riff kind of at the very beginning started the whole thing, and it developed from there. Mm-hmm. And as I developed it, I tried to keep the things that I was trying to strive for, the more melodic sound in mind, and that's where it came from.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned in your biography, well, I don't know if you mentioned, it was mentioned in your biography, that you had a rare opportunity to see both Leo Kottke and Michael Hedges play together at the Barrymore Theater in Madison. Mm-hmm. How old were you when this, when was this?
I was probably about 15, so it would have been... probably 1995 or 96. And I remember I was a freshman in high school, and they played together at the Barrymore, and I went with my parents and my older brother, and it was just, you know, my jaw just hit the floor. It was just incredible. And I kind of knew at that point that I wanted to play the guitar and have music in my life, you know, for a long time. And at that point, I really didn't, I think I maybe owned a guitar, but I didn't actually play it. So that's when I started picking it up and trying to do something with it. And from what I remember, those two loved performing together, but they didn't do it very often. Although I found out when I moved here that they actually performed at the Krannert Center together, which would have been a marvelous show, you know. And but yeah, it was something that I remember even to this day.
And kind of got it all started for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned earlier about writing lyrics, so let's talk about that a little bit. You mentioned some of the people who you thought were some of the best songwriters of our day: Willie Porter, Peter Mulvey, Patty Larkin, Martin Sexton. You say that these musicians whetted your appetite for songwriting and fostered a strong appreciation for the well-penned lyric. Tell me, what inspires lyrics for you? Because you write the lyrics for your own your own works, right?
Yep, that's correct. Well, I think, first and foremost, life experience inspires a lot. In my case, my childhood and upbringing expired a lot. I think it's really to really write something that's very truthful, it definitely has to come from some sort of life experience. You may not be connected to that experience firsthand, but it has to be rooted in some sort of truth. And so I look to, you know, life experiences, stories, things mm-hmm. I remember from childhood, you know, things my family members have told me about, or things my friends have told me about, mm-hmm. And try to find something in all that that maybe an audience can connect to in general, mm-hmm. and start from there.
Mm-hmm. I like to look at one of your songs, Ernie.
Mm-hmm.
You say, Ernie was an old man. When I was a boy, his body gave way, but he didn't give a damn. Ernie was an old man. Ernie spoke of his wife from way back in the day, he said. She passed on now long ago and left me on this farm all alone. And I cried like hell the day she died, the day she died. Tell me about Ernie.
Well, Ernie was a bachelor farmer that I knew. He wasn't a bachelor. I mean, he had been married and his wife had passed away. And he was a farmer that lived on a farm that my dad would go to when I was a boy. And he lived on the farm with his son. His son's name was Dwayne. And so they lived on this farm together, and we used to go out there and help them put up hay and visit them. They were just two of the most incredible characters you would ever meet. And some of the lyrics in this tune, are very, very truthful and literal. And then some of the other things are I took liberties with and made up a little bit. Like, in particular, the song goes on to read, later in the second verse, it says, Ernie gets along fine. Next month, he'll be 99. That's a little bit of a stretch. He was never actually 99. with a shotgun behind the door and his six guns there in the silverware drawer. And they literally kept a pair of six guns in the silverware drawer. I remember them taking them out and showing them to me when I was a kid. And, those are the types of things when you look back at them, you know, as a kid, you just thought these were normal people. Mm-hmm. And then as you grow up and you kind of look back at it, you realize how exceptional knowing those two people was as part of your childhood. And that's where that tune came from.
Yeah, and not knowing at the time that one day it would become a part of your art.
That's correct, yeah.
Well, that's Ernie, quite a character, with a shotgun behind the door, six guns in the silverware drawer, and when he died, all he had was a pocket full of skull. You paint him very, very vividly and illustrate him very much with music, Michael Kamin.
Well, thank you. He actually chewed Copenhagen, but skull fit into the lyric better.
Well, a little poetic license here. I'm speaking with Michael Kamin, singer, songwriter, and acoustic guitarist. He's going to be performing in Cranert on Thursday, part of the Cranert Uncorked series, and that starts at 5 p.m. in the lobby of the Cranert. And you'll be doing primarily instrumental work on this program at the Cranert. Is that correct?
That's correct, yep.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be talking a little bit more about that in just a minute. I need to take care of a little business right now and tell you that support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign. providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of chocolates, cheeses, oils, balsamic vinegar, jam, spices, barbecue sauces, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. I'm Roger Cooper, sitting in for Kevin Kelly this afternoon on Live and Local. Michael Kameen is my guest, and during the second portion of our program, I'll be speaking with Stephen Bussard, an organist. Today's weather calls for increasing clouds, highs around 82, light southerly winds, and becoming northwesterly around 5 miles an hour in the afternoon. Cloudy skies expected tonight with a 30% chance of showers and lows near 62. Tomorrow, partly sunny with highs around 85, winds from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles an hour. 79 degrees at present here on the campus of the University of Illinois. The time is 12:24. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL-FM-HD2, Urbana. Thank you for tuning in. Michael, you moved to central Illinois from, you grew up in Wisconsin.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And you came here to accompany your wife, who is here in graduate school. And according to your biography, it says your hands have finally caught up with your head. And you're playing various venues now, from farmers markets to coffee houses, college towns. And you're kind of finding your edge as a seasoned musician. What have your experiences been like playing in all these local venues and for such a wide variety of people?
Oh, they've been great. Over the past couple of years, I've found myself with opportunities to play in places where I would otherwise probably never go. Mm-hmm. You know, little towns across Illinois, and I don't play so much out of town anymore. But when I did, it was you know, a lot of fun, and you meet a lot of people. You know, people are always appreciative. And it's just something that sometimes, you know, it's a lot of work, and sometimes mm-hmm. you question why it is you're doing it, you know, but ultimately it's something that you look back on and will be glad that you have done, and be glad for the experience. And I guess that's kind of why I keep doing it, you know, is you just kind of never know what's going to happen to you, who you're going to meet, what you're going to end up doing, mm-hmm. you know, in these various places. And and that's it. You know, that's you're out kind of doing what you like to do, and that, I think, is the most important thing.
And you'll probably get a lyric or two out of the experience as well.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Now, we've heard selections from two CDs. The first one, Strong Mind, was released in 2006, featured five original songs. The first piece, Introduction, that we heard was from that album. The song Ernie that we heard is from the second album, entitled Cold Pines. What goes through your head when you, you know, you make a CD and you're holding it in your hand for the very first time? What do you think?
You think, did I just waste a lot of money? No, I think doing a recording project and recording music is ultimately your most lasting mark as a musician. It's an incredible growth process. Recording music is incredibly hard. There is no forgiveness behind the microphone. Live performance is fleeting. You know, you can go out and perform a gig and make mistakes, and that gig and those mistakes are gone, and nobody's ever going to really know about them again. And it's sort of very much in the moment. Whereas mm-hmm. a recorded piece, you know, you record it and you listen to it, and as the artist or the musician, you know, your mistakes are glaring, and everybody knows that they're their own worst critic, but that doesn't make it any easier. So you learn to grow, and you learn to let things go a little bit. And but finally, you know, you come to the term come to terms with the fact that this thing that you recorded is, you know, you're part of what you're putting out there for history. I mean, that CDs and that recorded music is probably going to be around a lot longer than you're going to be around, and that's what people may or may not remember about you. And so you try to do your best, but you also have to realize that you're only in a certain at a certain spot in your development as an artist. And while you may not do as well as you had hoped to do, you can't really do any better.
So, what do you want the audience to take away from a Michael Kamin concert?
I think I would like them to walk away with, you know, a little bit of a, and I guess I hope to improve their day. I hope to put a little bit of good energy and good feeling and love out there. You know, as sort of corny as that sounds, but you know, music is such an incredible thing that if you can bring that to somebody and touch their lives a little bit and brighten their day a little bit, then you've kind of accomplished your goal, you know. So I hope to sort of bring a little good feeling and a little good energy to everybody. And if I can do that, I think I've done a good job.
You've just revealed yourself to be not only a musician, but also a humanitarian and a swell human being. And Michael Kamin, again, performing in the Krannert Uncorked, that's coming up this Thursday. It starts at 5 p.m. in the Krannert Lobby. Michael will be performing primarily acoustic guitar music, and you're playing solo?
That's correct.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, it starts at 5 p.m. in the Krannert. Michael has two CDs, Strong Mind, released in 2006, and his newest one is Cold Pines. And as we say goodbye to Michael, we're going to hear a piece from Cold Pines entitled, I think this one is Sea Legs.
Which track is it?
Six. Or did we already hear Sea Legs?
We already did that one. We could do maybe number three, Sooner or Later.
Okay, Sooner or Later. Here we go.
Sooner or later, this'll all pay off. The 7 day weeks, the well spent hours, we'll have a home with a screen door.
Michael Kamin performing, and he will be performing in the Krannert Uncorked, and that's coming up this Thursday at 5 p.m. Hope to see you there. My next guest on Live and Local is Stephen Michael Bizzard. The name Bizzard is certainly no stranger to musicians and organists in our listening area. I say musicians and organists tongue-in-cheek. I guess I should have said musicians and especially organists. And also longtime listeners to WILL, because Stephen is the son of John Paul Bizzard, who, in addition to being the proprietor of the Bizzard Pipe Organ Company in Champaign, is a former host here on WILL. You may remember him from hosting Nocturne and Classics by Request. And Stephen's mother, Linda, is organist and choir master at St. John the Divine. So, Stephen, you come from a long line of musicians and organists, though your own credentials are quite impressive on their own. I guess it's not necessary to ask you how you became interested in the organ.
Yes, indeed.
How old were you when you began your interest in the organ?
I started taking organ lessons after several years of piano. I was about 13. I did a summer course called Pipe Organ Encounters, which was hosted here at the University of Illinois, and that's a chance for students who have some piano background to be exposed to the organ. Obviously, for me, I had been exposed to it before, but that was my first week of getting to really try it out and practice it for many hours a day.
Yeah. And Well, with both parents being organists and your father involved in building organs, I imagine you've been around pipe organs all of your life.
Definitely, yeah.
And in my mind, I can easily see a little kid playing around on the floorboard, on the keyboard. And do you have any confessions about that to make to us?
Well, since nobody is listening, one story my dad likes to tell is that when I was an infant, he would put on records of King's College Choir doing anthems or Anglican chant, and then we would dance around the room with me on his shoulders. So I guess that would be the first exposure.
I can easily see John Paul doing that as well. Now, you mentioned you came to organ after studying piano, which, as I imagine, that's the route most organists go. Does anyone ever start on the organ?
I'm sure, yeah. I think most organists have had experience in other keyboard instruments, especially because if you want to start playing at a younger age, the organ, you can't really reach the pedals yet.
Yeah.
So there's a certain age requirement, or at least minimum height requirement.
Now, I see that you studied piano with Roger Shields.
Mm-hmm.
He has quite a reputation for turning out gifted and accomplished young pianists. Were you ever tempted to stay with the piano?
Well, I certainly enjoy playing the piano still, and I practice the piano a lot. And church musicians especially have to use the piano for rehearsals. In college, I played for many of the choirs on campus on the piano. So I still sort of consider myself a pianist to a certain extent. But really, I fell in love with the organ for many reasons. I feel like the possibilities for different orchestral colors are really exciting about the organ. I've always loved the use of the organ in a worship setting. It really sort of sets a transcendent mood if played really well, both in the hymns and improvisations, in literature playing. So that's what really grabbed my attention about the organ.
Mm-hmm. I tell you what, let's hear you play something.
Great.
And then we'll come back and talk some more.
Great.
So this being live and local, of course, Stephen has dragged up a huge pipe organ to the studio. And not only that, he's also brought in Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau to perform a song that he has transcribed. This is Du bist die Ruhe, sung by Franz Schubert. Du bist die Ruhe, thou art peace, or thou art repose. A very beautiful song by Franz Schubert, and we heard it in transcription. Stephen Bizard made the organ transcription, and he is my guest here on Live and Local. I'm Roger Cooper, sitting in for Kevin Kelly. Two things about this, Stephen. First off, I'm struck by the colorings that you use in the registration. I think they beautifully fit the colorings of Schubert's harmonies. He's known for his unusual harmonies, and I think your colorings just fit them beautifully. The other thing that strikes me about this, and I know this is just me, and people who know organists will probably smile at my naivete, but I always associate the organ with a lot of pomp and pageantry, and I'm struck by the intimacy.
I think that's one thing that a lot of people don't realize the organ is capable of. The softs can be just as exciting as the louds.
Yeah, and it's just lovely. Very nice.
Thank you.
Do you sing
Thank
as
you.
Well?
Yeah, I do. And that was one inspiration behind
Yeah, I as I listen to this, I think there's the soul of a singer in there. and I think that's a great thing to find in an instrumentalist.
Definitely.
Of course, I know I'm going back to musicians and organists again, so I'm going to get in trouble. But
well, I went to Westminster Choir College, and mm-hmm. every student at Westminster has to sing in choir every day, and we're all given at least 2 years of voice lessons. So I really didn't know the song literature very well until I got to school mm-hmm. and started taking voice lessons. And my teacher introduced me to this CD of Fischer Dieskau. And I sort of realized that it would make a good organ piece when I heard Du bist die Ruhe. I was listening to it on my iPod while I was making copies at church, you know, doing the menial tasks. And I just sort of struck by, hey, this would really work very well on the organ.
Very nice. I always thought that all instrumentalists should be required to sing. All singers should be required to read and recite poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell me... you are probably more aware than most organists at your age of the ins and outs and the mechanics of the organ simply because of your background.
Mm-hmm.
How has that helped you? How has that given you an advantage, or has it over other organists?
I don't know if it's necessarily given me a huge advantage. One big advantage of being the son of an organ builder, though, is that my dad tries to get out to some of my concerts, and if something goes wrong, which... I don't know, I get really bad luck where stuff goes wrong while I'm practicing, but he's able to get in there and fix it. So that's nice. Otherwise, yeah, it is. I think it's really important to know how your instrument works, and a lot of organists really don't quite understand the connection between the keys and the pipes.
I remember my own days in undergraduate school where, well, I was a voice major, and all of us music majors kind of all hung in the same part of the dorms and stuff. And we all used to laugh at the organ majors because they would get a recording of an organist and, oh, man, they just get so excited about the 64-foot and the Rombards and the this, that, and the others. Of course, as singers, we would be the same way, I guess, about a new recording of a Joan Sutherland or Beverly Sills. So I guess this all comes around to the same thing. What is your primary interest in organ music? Is it Baroque, contemporary, liturgical?
I have a lot of different interests. I tend to draw mostly toward the romantic repertoire and also do transcriptions and trying to be orchestral mm-hmm. with the organ and using registration to be expressive. That sort
now,
of
is that an unusual, field or interest for mm-hmm. organists? I mean, I guess, again, my naivete about organists, of course, think about Baroque music with organists
sure.
primarily.
It's actually an older tradition, especially mm-hmm. in this country. It's a very American tradition. Back in the 1920s, before people could really hear high-quality recordings and orchestras were not cheap, a lot mm-hmm. of organists would play orchestral music at the organ to really provide that source of entertainment. That has since faded out because people can get recordings. And during the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the Baroque music and interpreting Baroque music in an historically informed way has really become a prominent field in the organ. Mm-hmm. And that's all great, too. But there's been a sort of resurgent school of symphonic organists, especially in the last 10 years. My organ teacher is definitely one of them, Ken Cowan. He does a lot of transcribing and a lot of orchestral coloration within registrations. So that's sort of where I've been headed personally.
Do you do a lot of transcribing? And how about composing?
A little bit. Yeah, I do some composing as well, mm-hmm. Sort of dabble in it. it's hard to find enough time to do everything.
But just, is there a piece by Bizard on here other than the arrangement?
Just the arrangement. Yeah.
We'll get back to some more of your playing in just a minute. I want to ask you for another question because you were talking about the Baroque and the traditions and stuff. I once interviewed a harpsichordist, and I asked her if there would ever be any improvements or innovations on the harpsichord, and she said no, because it was already a perfect instrument, mm-hmm. and so there was no need to make any, you know, any improvements and stuff. That's not necessarily true with the organ, though, is it?
Yeah, it's not true because I really feel that depending on the era and the location of the organ and what repertoire it was designed to play each organ can be a very different instrument. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, it's not as effective to play Bach on a 1920s Ernest Skinner organ because that's designed to do really thick orchestral mm-hmm. sounding pieces or romantic music. But then an organ that Bach would have known would probably not do so well with César Franck. Mm-hmm.
So that's something that organists have to consider, though. Mm-hmm. Like when you are recording or even performing, you have to choose your repertoire according to whatever instrument is available. Is that true?
Definitely, mm-hmm. definitely. That's a really important thing. You have to be diverse enough in your repertoire to be able to select music that's appropriate for the venue that you'll be playing.
I want to hear more of your playing, but it's just so fascinating talking to you that I hope we get some more of that in. Because I see that you were the organ scholar when you were at Westminster. And in fact, you're on your way next week to England, where you'll be organ scholar at the Wells Cathedral. Tell us mm-hmm. a little bit about that. First of all, what does an organ scholar do? And then tell us about Wells Cathedral.
Well, organ scholar can be a very different sort of term. It really depends on the place. In Princeton, I was organ scholar at Trinity Church Princeton, which has a large choir program. So my main job with my partner in crime, Tom Sheehan, was to accompany the choir in all of their anthems and even songs. And then we would also play the literature. So we would do preludes and postludes, and just sort of generally assist with the running of that program. They had mm-hmm. five different choirs there, so there was a lot to do between the director and the two of us. Mm-hmm. At Wells, I'm going to be senior organ scholar, which is basically third in the pecking order. There's organist who directs the music, assistant organist who does the majority of the accompanying, then myself, and then a junior organ scholar who's a little younger. At Wells, there's a particularly busy schedule because they do evensong literally every day, Monday through Sunday, and then two more services on Sunday morning. And they have two choirs, boys and girls, which are usually separate, and they are all in residence at the cathedral school. So between the two choirs, there's a lot of rehearsing to do. They often rehearse at the same time, so it really is kind of an all-hands-on-deck situation. Already in my first week, I'm going to get to do some directing of evensongs and things.
Oh, that's great. Is this your first trip to England? Or
I've been a few times. I had to go to audition last year. Mm-hmm. I've also gone there with my family once, and with the choir at Trinity, we did a choir tour.
Ah, great. Let's hear you play some more. How about, I guess I've chosen the finale from the Mendelssohn Sonata.
Great.
That's music by Felix Mendelssohn from his Sonata No. 4 in B-flat major, the finale, and it was performed by Stephen Bizard, who is my guest this afternoon here on Live and Local. I'm Roger Cooper sitting in for Kevin Kelly this afternoon. WILL programming is made possible by the University of Illinois School of Music, presenting the Allerton Music Barn Festival September the 2nd through the 6th at Allerton Park. For more information, visit www.allertonmusicbarn.com. And thank you for listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL-FM and HD1 and HD2 Urbana, translators W266 AF Urbana, W293 AF Danville. We have just a few minutes left, Stephen, so I want to thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And sharing your art with us, and very entertaining, very engaging.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, with all of the new digital technologies available now, mm-hmm. and I'm sure there's been lots of innovations as far as the big electronic organs. Mm-hmm. I guess I think Alan is the name that comes to mind.
Yeah.
Right off, and I see that look that most pipe organists get when you mention electronic organs.
Yeah.
So, but I want to ask you, what do you think is the future of organ music, organ repertoire, as when you think in terms of synthesizers and electric organs and all of the things that the modern technology is able to bring to bear?
I think that electronic organs oftentimes can be a solution for a church that, for whatever reason, space or money can't have a pipe organ. But I think that in general, pipe organs are the much preferable way to go. The church where I played, Trinity Princeton, has had an electronic organ for a little while because they're sort of trying to start a pipe organ project to mm-hmm. replace an older pipe organ. And it's sort of an unideal solution to a problem. But ultimately, I think, especially in churches, that it's a philosophical issue of having something real making the sound. Just as you don't want to have electric candles at the altar, I think that having real instruments making real sound is just a better thing to do. And the sound, I think, really has a much better presence with pipes than it does with electronic speakers. Part of it, I think, is that the organ just has an acoustic property of being spread out over a larger space that helps it amplify into the room, whereas a small speaker can only really do so much.
And, of course, it has the feeling, the presence of ages mm-hmm. in that sound
yeah,
itself.
Definitely, that's important.
But one question in leaving, what's wrong with electric candles on the altar?
Yeah.
That's music by Viern, performed by Stephen Bizard on the pipe organ at Second Presbyterian Church in Bloomington, Illinois. And this was an organ built by Bizard Pipe Organ Company, which is a company started and operated by Stephen's father, John Paul. As I mentioned earlier, a former announcer here at WILL. A quick look at this afternoon's weather. Cloudy skies with a high of 82. Cloudy skies tonight. There's a chance of showers and an isolated thunderstorm after midnight. The low at 62, partly sunny tomorrow, and there's a high of 85 degrees. Thursday, mostly sunny and warmer. The high expected to be near 88. 81 degrees at present here on the campus of the University of Illinois. Stephen, I want to thank you once again for coming in, sharing your sparkling personality and your mm-hmm. talent with us here at WILL.
Thank you.